So we're at this point within the agency exploring our options. I think I've indicated to you before that there's some feeling that if the council wasn't able to make the deadline, then the agency under secretarial authority would have to take action. So I did want to raise that to the council and express our concerns once again with the time that this is taking.
Pat, RSSC is going to meet in August to make recommendations on the ABC, so if the service or the secretary were to do a secretarial action, you would wait until you get that recommendation, and then you would just implement an action that would put an ABC in place?
Is that ACL, yeah.
In the ACL?
I think that's what makes the most sense, but I can't tell you that it's my decision.
Paul.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. So we had planned on doing things in June at this meeting on approving alternatives, but we're approving alternatives in September. So at the next council meeting, we'll approve alternatives for ACLs and AMs and the ABC and AC, under the SSC guidance. And then, so that's September, and then we hopefully will vote on the draft, the DEIS in November, hold some public hearings in end of November, December, and then have the final vote in January. So I don't know how confident I am we're in that, but I think the service needs to know, because I've been reporting on this at the national level that we're going to get this done, and it's now been delayed till January. So does the chair of the committee, are you confident that we'll be able to vote in January? If not, you're going to be left with a secretarial amendment.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay. Just waiting for the scientific
ABC.
Data at this point.
Okay.
I mean, we've done, you know, we had our how to set the ABC has been approved by the SSC at the April or March meeting.
Okay.
And now my understanding is that basically the people that are working on Whiting are working on the track, and they haven't got time to work on Whiting at the moment. So it's more a, okay. You know, a staffing issue. And once they get done with the track, they'll get back to, you know, getting the information that the SSC needs for its August meeting to set the ACL. It's just a staff issue more than anything else.
So we'll move forward and with confidence deliver the final vote in January according to this timeline, Pat. I don't know if that's acceptable. But
unfortunately, it was the January timeline that caused concern, so I don't think... I think it's still an issue.
Well, if that's the case, then should we even bother? I mean, if January is the best we can do with our schedule and system, and that's problematic and it's going to cause a secretarial action, then maybe we shouldn't even continue through our process.
Well, I still think the council process is preferable to a secretarial action, and I frankly can't think of a secretarial action that the council's liked and hasn't replaced anyway. I'd strongly encourage the council to continue through your process and hope that you know, does in fact satisfy the concerns about meeting the statutory deadline.
Any further on this issue? Okay. Any other questions for Pat? Maggie?
Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. Pat, it's my understanding that you're seriously considering a decision to end the dockside monitoring program for groundfish this year. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, I just wanted to bring to the council's attention a letter that I delivered this morning that's addressed to Pat from the Sustainable Harvest Sector asking you not to eliminate the dockside monitoring program.
So I think, as the council knows, we did originally put in place a requirement for the dockside monitors to go into the hold. We removed that requirement. I've previously expressed concerns about the effectiveness of the program without that requirement, and frankly, you know, the way the program has been designed overall, we don't see that it's serving a very important purpose. It's certainly not providing us any information, and it's not clear that it's accomplishing its intended purpose either in terms of monitoring the catch. So we are looking at phasing that program out, potentially phasing that program out this year. That would still leave it in place beginning again in 2013, but funded by the industry at that point. And part of it is that, you know, we see a higher priority use for this funding given the effectiveness of the program. So we certainly support effective monitoring and think it's critical to this program, to the sector program, but we don't think that we're getting effective monitoring out of the dockside monitoring program as it's currently designed.
Jenny?
Yeah, well, as an industry member, I disagree. I think that the program does offer some deterrent, and I think we will be very sorry if that program goes away and you will see an escalation of blackfish. I don't know of any major catch system that hasn't had to be dockside monitored. I mean, I'd prefer myself 100%, and then you're going to be monitored. But even at 67% of the time, people know that they're assigned a monitor. Then if they're unloading fish somewhere or at some time without that monitor being there, that's a violation, and it makes it a lot easier for law enforcement to pick up on that. And I don't know if they have, but I do know that there's a deterrent factor there to somebody trying to take fish off a boat or move fish that is not recorded. So I think the program should remain in place, and I think it should be, you know, in 2013 go to 100%, but we couldn't get there at this point. So I don't know what else has more priority for that funding, but we will find out after the fact that we wish we had been monitored in a better way. At this point right now, at least 100% of the trips in one form or another are monitored, either at sea or at a dock. I mean, that's the first time we've ever had that level of some kind of monitoring in this fisheries, and I think it's important for it to continue. Thank you.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Pat, I think I misunderstood you. Did you say that the funding for the dockside monitoring would be phased out next year and industry would be required to pay for the dockside monitoring? So it still would be there, but industry would pay for it. Is that what you said, or was something else intended?
No, the way the program is designed right now is that dockside monitoring is funded this year and next up to available federal funds, and then the industry assumes full responsibility for the program in 2013.
So the program is not going to be phased out. The port sampling will still be there, but there'll be a requirement that industry pay for it.
In 2013.
David?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I agree with Pat. I mean, I've watched his program. I've unloaded 11 days in June here. I just don't see it getting us anything. The joint enforcement agreements will get far more results then will, you know, a guy who stands on the pier and watches fish come in and then goes in and watches people weigh them. It's not producing any usable results. It's just another layer of bureaucracy that doesn't, you know, the information they collect isn't used. It doesn't match the weigh-out slips a lot of times. Unfortunately, it was maybe necessary to try it out the first year, but I haven't seen anything that it's done as a deterrent. Now, you know, you send a thing that says, that you're going to be in, and if that goes to enforcement, then they have an option of going down and checking that boat, and that's random. That's what you need, is you don't know when a guy's going to pop out of the bushes and come and look in your boat. These people here are very nice. They're well-meaning. But they just don't do anything. And we have that trip start and trip end hail thing. It doesn't work at all. I think I've had maybe one out of 13 that's actually gone through successfully. The acknowledgments now seem to be going through reasonably well. And the thing you send to the government with the logbook number, because it's only one character or one set of characters, seems to go through reasonably well. But when you send that thing to the dockside monitoring company that has, I don't know, requests 8 or 10 different things, those things sit on the SkyMate, and that's where they sit. They just sit. I have to call on the cell phone every single day, and I can't call until I get cell phone service. It just doesn't work. Again, with technology, we mean well. But it's beyond the realm of the technology we have at this time. And so I think we could simplify the VMS situation a lot by getting rid of that trip start and trip end situation with the monitors. Again, they're nice people. They're well-meaning. They've monitored the co-op. I've been monitored 100% of my trips, including the observed trips. And yet I've talked to people that unload at outports, and they might have been monitored one time out of 10 because the monitors don't make any money going to the outports. They make money sitting there at the dock collecting money to watch a stream of boats come in. So I just don't think the program as it's currently designed is really capable of catching anybody. It's kind of like sending out Inspector Clouseau. You know, the Pink Panther might get somebody by mistake, but they're not going to get them on purpose. So... I have to disagree with Jimmy on this. That I think the joint enforcement agreement is what you need to catch people that might be unloading blackfish. Mr. Living.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I have a question about the contracts. As I understand it, the sectors have contracted with these monitors to provide this service. That's a legal contract. And then the money to pay for it comes in. It's funneled back into the sector directly to the provider. What's going to happen if the money dries up? Are the sectors going to still be liable for these legal contracts and have to pay these contracts, or has that been considered? Thank you.
Yeah, we have looked at the contractual obligation issues, but we're not familiar with the contracts that every sector has signed. It's been considered. We can talk about it if you think there's an issue. We've not gotten the impression from the dockside monitors or others that there is sector managers or the dockside monitors. They're all funding contingent.
Okay, thanks, Pat. That was a conversation that did come up with us in a sector meeting that we had. We were just wondering about that. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Anything else for Pat? Jim?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Kendall, New Bedford Seaver Consulting. I don't want to get into arguing the points of the program, but just to make sure I've got this clear. Pat, you're suggesting that the services funding of this program may end for a period of time, and then at a future point, the industry will pick it up again under its own requirement for payment.
Right. That's the way the regulations are written.
All right. Well, I'm having a problem wrapping my mind around the fact that it's not important enough for the service to continue funding. yet at some future date, it'll be worth it if the industry funds it. How does that determination come into play?
Jim, back, I think it was in Amendment 16, the council wrote the regs such that the service, if funds were available, would fund this program, and then the council also said it, I think it was 2013, the industry would assume the cost for the program. So
I understand that, John.
That's where we are right now. So for that to change, the council would need to take action.
I understand that. But if you sit back and you look at the fact that the service doesn't think it's valuable enough to continue on without the ability to go down into the fish hole, which seems to be the triggering event on this issue, then how is that about to change when the industry has to be liable for the funding? If it's not worth it today, why is it worth it when it comes out of someone else's pocket? And I'm sure that if that's the whole basis of discontinuing this program, one, you either continue the program and suck up the costs like the industry will be required, or at some point you say no one should be liable for payment of a program that we feel doesn't have that worth. So I just find there's a disconnect in logic here that, like I say, it's all right depending on who pays for it.
Well, I think you were wrong. You did get your mind wrapped around it, and that's the debate that the council's been having today, and I think it's going to continue. And the fact that the industry is going to be on the hook in 2013 to deal with it, I think, is going to make this a discussion point that's going to come up, and we're going to have a resolution one way or the other through the council. So I think you characterized it very well. Pat?
Yeah, and that's an issue I raised in my letter to the council on dockside monitoring, but that's not – the hold issue is not the only issue. It's also a priority issue and a budget issue, and frankly, we just don't use the data from the dockside monitoring. There's some funding. There's currently some funding available now that we think is better used for supporting the sectors, but we don't expect the same level of funding in 2012. I think we're all looking at significant reductions in 2012, and so we need to start thinking a little more clearly about priorities and making sure that we're using the funding we have in the most effective way.
Okay, NOAA General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have too much to report today in terms of updating litigation. With respect to the Amendment 16 lawsuit filed in Massachusetts Federal District Court by New Bedford, Gloucester, and a slew of other plaintiffs, we received a motion from the New Bedford, Gloucester plaintiffs to supplement the complaint in order to bring into the litigation framework 45, the implementation of 45. We filed it. I've been on leave for the last week out of town. An opposition to the motion to supplement the complaint on grounds that the case has already been briefed and orally argued, and that this kind of further delay is not appropriate in this lawsuit, and that the plaintiffs could file a separate lawsuit if they so desired. There's also pending still the appeal by Food and Water Watch of the court's denial of that group's motion to intervene as a plaintiff. The court denied that motion in preliminary proceedings. Food and Water Watch was allowed to file a friend of the court brief, but they've appealed the decision to enter as a party, and there's been that's still the future course of that appeal is still pending. All the briefs have been filed in the other Amendment 16 lawsuit filed by Oceana in the D.C. Federal District Court. And so we're awaiting further instructions from the court concerning possible oral arguments in that case. In the case of the Western Sea plaintiff's challenge to Amendment 1 to the Herring FMP, which challenged primarily the permit splitting prohibition provision, that was a case in which The federal district court held in favor of the plaintiffs, knocking, basically invalidating the prohibition on allowing applicants who had split permits to receive a limited access herring permit for the plaintiffs. That in that case, the federal government appealed that decision. We are still in looking at possibly settling that case with the plaintiffs, and there's been no final decision on whether to go forward with the appeal in light of the settlement negotiations that are ongoing. We've also, as I've reported previously, were sued by environmentally, partially by environmentally interested groups with respect to Herring Amendment 4. And I'm not the lead attorney in that case. Another attorney in my office, the deputy regional counsel, Denise Desatel, is the lead attorney there. But they were in the final throes of preparing the administrative record and filing an answer in that case. I'm not sure whether that was done in my absence or not. I got back last night. I attempted to call her this morning and have not been able to reach her. But we're basically still in the very preliminary procedural stage of that particular case. And that concludes my report, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Gene, I didn't know you weren't in last week, but I sent an email. There was a Federal Register item about that a council member sent us, and I sent it to all council members and asked you for some guidance. It's a Federal Register item about commodities and futures trading that deal with catch shares, and I didn't know if it would be germane to our sector trading and our IFQ trading, and I was wondering if you probably hadn't.
I haven't been able to go through my emails.
But if you could do that as soon as you can, I'd appreciate it.
Questions for Gene? Thanks, Gene. Oh, Mary Beth.
Just one quick question on the suit on Herring Amendment 4. I was wondering if you could remind us what the basis of that suit is. What are they suing on?
Well, I think primary basis had to do with whether we adequately dealt with bycatch, like a river herring and shad, whether those should have been included as species in the FMP. And I have to go back, and because I have not been involved with that case since we filed it, but I can go back and see what other issues might have been in that and talk to you, report back to the council if they want to know on that. Thanks.
Dr. Pierce.
Gene, has there been any further discussion regarding confidentiality issues relative to sector management, confidentiality of sector data? We discussed this issue briefly a few council meetings ago, I think. You indicated that Joel McDonald was the one, of course, who was, in the lead regarding positions to be developed on that issue. So has there been any further development on whether the data truly are confidential and whether the service will continue to treat sectors as, sectors as a person?
As far as I know, there hasn't been any change in that position, that they're considered to be submitters of required data that they're required to submit and that they therefore fall under the confidentiality provision of the Madison-Stevens Act. Double-check with my office to see if there's been any change since the last couple weeks that I might not be aware of. I think there, if there were, we'd be sending out some sort of letter or notice about that change.
Okay, and formal correspondence with Eric Schwab, my agency, raised the issue once again and hoped that there would be, further discussion on this issue and that the outcome would be transmitted to the council as soon as possible, since it has great relevance with reference to the work that we are doing on excessive shares, consolidation, and the like. But sure, so if you could pursue that, be appreciated. Thank you.
Someone else for Gene? Thanks, Gene. Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Dr. Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll start with some information about surveys and then move into stock assessments and meetings. The 2011 spring multi-species bottom trawl survey was completed on May the 12th. Regarding the scallop survey, leg one was completed on schedule on May the 21st, and it covered southern New England and the Delmarva region. Leg two departed from Woods Hole on June 8th and is completed, and that covered the Georges Bank area, and that completed the resource evaluation component of the survey. Right now, leg three is out, and its purpose is primarily to evaluate the HABCAM system, which is a camera-based survey approach. Some other surveys which are currently scheduled: the Herring Hydroacoustic Survey is scheduled to begin on September the 8th on the Delaware 2. The Clam Dredge Survey will begin on July the 11th, also on the Delaware 2. There's an industry clam industry cooperative clam dredge cruise scheduled to begin on August the 23rd. The Northern Shrimp Survey is scheduled for July the 10th on the Gloria Michelle. Regarding stock assessments, we have just completed in Woods Hole the 52nd saw sark and the three winter flounder stocks. There were benchmark assessments done, and they were peer-reviewed. We don't have any reports yet. The peer reviewers are still writing their reports, and we're still have editing to do on the science reports, and we expect to have those published in late July or early August. The center is also actively involved in this augmented groundfish PDT, doing work on the GARM stocks for updating, seeing if the stocks are on track for their rebuilding, and that will provide information into the SSC for making recommendations on adjustments. The track, as Paul Howard indicated, the track is ongoing this week. That's in St. Andrews, Canada, with the transboundary stocks from Georges Bank. The center is also actively engaged in updates for the Mid-Atlantic Council stocks, such as bluefish, black sea bass, scup, fluke, and dogfish. SARC 53 is scheduled for late November, early December of 2011, and the two stocks on the agenda there are black sea bass and Gulf of Maine cod. So those will be benchmark assessments and peer review. And then SARC 54 is scheduled for June of 2012. And southern New England yellowtail flounder and herring are the two stocks that are scheduled there. I wanted to mention that for the Mid-Atlantic Council primarily, there's this week in Woods Hole, there's a CIE review going on for the surf clam and ocean quahog fishery. And the peer review is an evaluation of developing a definition of what an excessive share is in the clam fishery. That concludes my report, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions, and Frank Almeida can help me out there if I can't answer. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. I have a question. I know you said that the scientific reports and the review team are still writing up the reports from the latest saw sark, but can you tell us whether or not all of the winter flounders have an approved stock assessment where they can create an ABC and an ACL?
Yeah, by the end of the saw sark meeting, we had a pretty good sense of what the reviewers were going to conclude, and I think that for southern New England stock of winter flounder, the results seem to be fairly consistent with the GARM results, that the stock didn't look like it's in good shape, and the and we do have determinations of stock status on that one, both the overfished and the overfishing determination. For George's Bank, I think the situation in terms of the stock looks a little more optimistic than it did in the GARM. And again, they were able to develop, make status determination criteria for that one. The Gulf of Maine stock is the one that was the most difficult in the GARM to assess. And again, it proved to be extremely difficult. But they were able to make some, using the modeling and then deciding what they could, from a scientific basis, what was reasonable to conclude. I think that they'll be giving us a biological reference point for whether or not the stock is undergoing overfishing, but I think that they were unable to come up with a definition of overfished. So in a nutshell, that's where we'll be at.
Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, Jim, regarding winter flounder, winter flounder, as well as the rest of the groundfish species, we've been using the proxies for FMSY. Do you know if we were actually able to, the scientists were actually able to come up with an FMSY value, so we don't need to rely on a proxy anymore?
That was a major topic of discussion at the SARC. A number of papers were brought in before the peer review panel, so they were well aware of the issue that's been debated in this council and in your SSC last winter and this spring. So I think that they were considering the estimates for the direct estimates as well as the proxies. They had a real healthy debate about which ones were most appropriate. And I think that in one case they may be using the direct estimates, whereas in another case they may not be. So I don't have the bottom line on that yet, but it certainly was everyone at that meeting was well aware of this issue, and it will be addressed in the reports.
Okay, thank you. You also mentioned that the Center for Independent Experts are meeting in Woods Hole or are about to meet in Woods Hole regarding the subject of excessive shears in the surf clam ocean quahog fishery. Would you have any idea as to who actually is involved in that review? Usually it's a group of scientists, you know, stock assessment scientists. Are these economists who will be doing this review?
Yes, they are. They're not stock assessment scientists. They are. The Mid-Atlantic Council was very concerned about that issue. They wanted to be very clear that the people that were brought in to review this would not be the usual biology stock assessment people. So they asked the CIE if they were capable of providing experts on this topic, and they were. And after a lot of back and forth, I think the Mid-Atlantic Council is satisfied in the way the selection took place. And as always, no one can actually choose the individuals that you get in an independent peer review, but they're satisfied that the credentials of the people that are coming in are adequate, or more than adequate.
Okay, very good. This council should pay attention to the outcome of that review, that's for sure. And then finally, I missed what you said regarding the objectives of the HABCAM work. HABCAM is an important tool for use in sea scallop surveys, HABCAM versus the SMAST work. So what are the expectations regarding what will be accomplished with this HABCAM work?
Well, I think this has been in development for some time. Dr. Scott Gallagher at HUI is the primary investigator who has developed this. And it's basically I think Frank Almeida can help me address this, but it's basically a high-tech camera system which will presumably survey scallops and can be done in conjunction with ground truthing tows that are taken to get actual estimates of scallops and their sizes and compared to what's seen in the surveys. But it's a very advanced approach to doing surveys.
I can add a little bit. I'm not exactly sure what the objectives of the survey are, but I know that I think they're working on HabCam 2, and it's a. I think they're testing the stereo cameras. So this is the HUI folks on the Sharp testing the new stereo cameras that they've developed. And it's whether I'm not sure whether or not they're actually revisiting stations that were conducted using the dredge survey or what, but they're out there. It's a development of the system. It's independent.
Harry, did I see your hand up? You got a HabCam question? Okay.
On the HabCam, more or less as Dr. Pierce was asking, this is being done on the Sharp, all of this work. So this is being funded by National Marine Fisheries.
I believe the HabCam project is a project that's funded through SINAR. So it was a competitive process that they went through, and it's a grant that went through the competitive process through SINAR.
So I don't even know what SINAR is.
SINAR is a cooperative institute for North Atlantic research. It's a cooperative institute that's with a series of six universities. Well, not just university, and GMRI is a member of them. That is it's a cooperative institute with NOAA, not just National Marine Fisheries Service. And the HabCam program, I think I'm not positive on this, but I believe that the continued development of the system is funded through SINAR.
Is funded through, excuse
through
me?
Through SINAR.
With so federal,
yes.
Federal monies?
Yes.
Okay. And this is the same camera that they've given the HabCam, the same thing we've seen. They've had it at some cooperative research meetings, correct? Same camera.
Yes.
That.
Yes.
It's not owned by the government. It's owned by Woods Hole Oceanographic, right?
Correct.
They're developing it.
Correct.
Trying to sell it, correct? But we're sort of developing it also, correct? And then they're looking later to sell it. Is that correct? That's what I've understood. I'm just asking if there's any clarification.
I can't answer that. That's their prerogative. I can't answer that.
But it does belong to Woods Hole Oceanographic, correct?
Yes.
The camera. Okay, thank you.
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, could you provide a few details on the Herring hydroacoustic survey?
Actually, I don't know a lot about it. I haven't been on that cruise before, so I'm kind of the wrong person to ask, but I know that the Herring benchmark assessment is scheduled in about a year, and that survey, the intention is to use the data collected with that in that assessment. And we've spoken quite a bit about evaluating the utility of those data, and I think Dr. Mike Check is working looking at retrospectively on previous surveys and seeing how they relate to our bottom trawl survey and so forth. But perhaps Frank can add to this, but I really don't know a lot about it.
Sorry for putting you on the spot.
So now you put me
on
the spot.
Sorry to put you on the spot, now Frank.
I agree with Jim. I think that the hydroacoustic survey is a program that's been running now for maybe 7 or 8 years. It's in the fall. It runs around the same time as the first or second leg of the bottom trawl survey. And the data, the biomass estimates that are generated from the hydroacoustic survey are used as an additional index in the assessment.
Maggie?
Thank you. Jim, do you know when the report of the peer review of the winter flounder assessments will be available to the public?
Yeah, I think that I'm due to receive those around July 15th. And that's not a hard deadline because if editors check those within the CIE directors. So the reviewers submit their reports to them, and they check them to make sure that they're complete, and they can send them back to the authors for corrections if they're incomplete. So there can possibly be a delay in there. But I've asked the reviewers to follow the directions very closely so that we try to make sure their reports will satisfy everybody that's reviewing them, and we'll get them on time. And if we get them earlier, we'll release them earlier. And they'll all be put out on our SAWSARC website along with the science reports.
Jim?
Just a quick question about the hydroacoustic studies. Do they still continue with the cooperative surveys where they utilize industry vessels as part of that survey, Frank?
The survey that Jim's talking about, the standard survey that's conducted by the center every fall, is a center project.
So it's been some time since I heard any mention of it with the industry vessels that were participating at one point. So I guess that's more or less fallen by the wayside?
No.
No?
I know that there are 1, 2, 3, 4. There are 5 projects that are being undertaken cooperatively with industry. In fact, I have a document in my hand that I haven't completed reading because it was just prepared last week earlier this week for headquarters. There's the Northeastern MIT project with the OAWRS system, and we've been working with them on that. Gulf Maine Institute Research Institute has requested some funds for us to do a cooperative project. I think that one is with research with commercial vessels. The problem with that one is that they need 50-50 funding or matching funding, and we couldn't do that in fiscal year 11. University of New Hampshire is primarily a data collection, data analysis program. There's a program with the National Institute of Undersea Science and Technology and University of Mississippi and South Mississippi, Rutgers, and SUNY Stony Brook. And they're looking at the multi-beam mapping in the Hudson Canyon. I'm not sure if that's with commercial vessels. I think that's on the Bigelow.
Well, it still
so that was a long answer to that.
Yeah,
that didn't really give you an answer.
Unfortunately, though, it doesn't really resolve some of the issues that I continue to have with it. It's been some time, like I say, since I've heard that there's been any incorporation of the commercial side of the acoustic study into the assessments of the resource. So I'm wondering if I'm correct or if that is, in fact, been a while since that information has been available or made part of the stock assessment.
I can't answer.
All right,
I don't know.
You,
but certainly in the 2012 assessment, whatever is available will be considered. But I can't answer your question directly. I'm sorry.
All right. At some point, if there is any information available on there, whether it has been utilized or for some reason hasn't been recently, I would like to get that information if at all possible. Thank you.
Mary Beth?
Talk about the Herring acoustic work. I mean, the federal program is an offshore acoustic survey that's been going on for some time, as Frank indicated. And then the industry that did participate in an inshore acoustic survey through GMRI that it didn't pass peer review. So it was not incorporated into the stock assessments. The peer reviewers did feel it was a good program, but they identified some significant issues so it was not included in the stock assessment. And people do continue to try to put together a program for that inshore portion of the resource. But the federal program has never attempted to do the inshore. It's an offshore program. But one question I did have for Frank or Jim, the Bigelow really is an acoustically high-tech vessel. And my understanding was that at some point that vessel would be gathering acoustic data as well, and I was wondering if that started to happen yet or plans to happen soon.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's one of the most, one of the quietest research ships in the world. And we do run the ME 70, I believe, during the bottom trawl survey. We've been doing that now for, I think, 2 years. And that's when I mentioned the cooperative work we're doing with UNH. It's to collect, archive, and analyze that data. So it is happening. The actual herring and mackerel hydroacoustic survey that's done in September is done on the Delaware, which isn't a quiet boat. But the decision to run it, to not run that on the Bigelow, had to do with the timing of the bottom trawl survey. We didn't want to disrupt the bottom trawl. The timing of the herring survey is when the herring are around, but it conflicted with the timing of the bottom trawl survey, and we chose not to move the dates of the bottom trawl survey because they've been underway since 1963. The plan is when the Delaware is replaced, probably in 2013 or 14, with the Pisces, which is a vessel that's in the Gulf right now. It's shared with the Southeast Science Center. When that vessel is, we're supposed to get half of that vessel, half of its time. And when that happens, the hydroacoustic survey, I believe, will move onto that vessel as well. It'll make it a better boat, a better survey, because it's run off a quiet boat.
Okay, moving on to Mid-Atlantic. Anything of note from the Mid-Atlantic Council meeting of last week that council members want to bring forward? No. Okay. U.S. Coast Guard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Karen, can you just go to the next slide? No, very short report this morning. My report covers the period 1 April to 21 June. During that time, we boarded 248 fishing boats and identified 4 violations for an observed compliance rate of 98.3%. Next slide. On the safety side, those same 248 boardings, we had we issued 34 safety violations for an observed compliance rate of 86.2%, and that includes 2 terminations. We responded to 26 casualties and 5 medevacs during that time frame as well, with 79 lives saved and 2 lives lost. Next slide. That concludes my report.
Any questions for the cap?
Answer any questions.
Any questions? Thanks, Cap. NIMS Enforcement, VMS.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Council. Jim Donovan, Acting SAC Enforcement. Universal Fish of Boston and President Thomas Katz were sentenced in U.S. District Court. Both had previously pled guilty to Lacey Act violations surrounding the false labeling of catfish. They received probation, and a total of $150,000 was fined. Of note, though, at sentencing, Judge William Young informed Thomas Katz, "Make no mistake, this is a crime and you should have gone to jail." Judge Young stated his reasons for not sentencing Katz to jail was because of Katz's medical condition. It's the first time we've seen that type of response from some of our judges up here in Massachusetts. Also, a Connecticut man was indicted in federal court with trafficking and falsifying records for illegally harvested Atlantic striped bass. The indictment charges the Connecticut fisherman, whose license in both Rhode Island and Massachusetts for harvesting striped bass in Rhode Island waters after the season had closed and then selling those fish in Massachusetts. The indictment charges that up to 12,000 pounds of striped bass have been legally harvested. So probably by the next council meeting, I'll have a resolution on that case. The director, Office of Law Enforcement, director position, I had really hoped to have it for you today. We've never been as close since Dale Jones had left to replacing our director, and that's going to happen at any day now. The Andy Cohen's former job that I'm covering right now, that job should be posted either this week or next week, and we'll bring in a full-time permanent position to fill that. We're still waiting on the priorities. I know I mentioned at previous meetings that they're going to go out for a public comment. Unfortunately, they just caught up in draft mode being reviewed. So as soon as I get those public the comments for the draft priorities for both regional and national enforcement. I will get them to the council, and I'll encourage everybody to provide some feedback. We're still working on our change in our posture. Don Fry and Sheila Johns are both here today again. Don's made great strides since he's picked up the compliance liaison position. He's out visiting the waterfront as often as he can. We're trying to, again, improve that compliance aspect through education and rapport with the industry. Along those lines, we are slowly building up our enforcement officer program. I've got an officer on station up in Ellsworth and one in New Bedford, and two officers are in training down at FLETC. Nationally, based on the IG review and the corrective actions from NOAA, our enforcement agent balance is going to change. I expect to see another 18 positions to be advertised nationally. We will pick up a couple of them. I still need positions in Gloucester and down in Newport News. Again, this is that transition that Office of Law Enforcement is going under right now from an agent corps to an agent officer corps, and the officers will be that direct link, again, down the waterfront. What's note, and I know we've got some pushback here and there on that, my goal up here in the Northeast is that enforcement officer program will be a very coordinated effort between ourselves, our JEA partners, and the U.S. Coast Guard. And the way it's going to work and be successful is if we can continue that coordination. Again, that this is a way that they believe the IG, NOAA, and from a lot of feedback from industry, is that this is the way to go towards improving compliance. So be happy to answer any questions.
Tim, any questions? Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Tim, I'm a little confused. And I don't understand how the addition of new uniformed officers in the Northeast region is going to address the IG's report, specifically in this state where we have a very strong JEA partnership with no law enforcement. We have men in uniform on the docks with good collaboration with the industry. And the concern is a little bit more than that, that the long-term funding of these positions might jeopardize our JEA funding and undo years' worth of good work by Maine Marine Patrol. So I guess it's with great concern that this program moves ahead.
Thank you, Terry. Completely different sets of funding. I've seen no indication, and I've told this to our JEA partners, that congressional funding appropriations will continue with the states up and down all 10 of our JEA partners. And one of the key factors of the IG review was they believe that we needed a better balanced approach from criminal investigators and regulatory compliance aspect of it. And the two venues we have to do that is with enforcement officers, which has been a very successful program in Alaska, and the addition to Don Fry as the new compliance liaison.
Paul Howard.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Tim, as the council wrestles with this monitoring versus enforcement and coming up on 2013 and less funding next year, when the Coast Guard reports, they report their activity at sea, boardings, and violations. Is there any way the council can get an understanding of the NIMS enforcement at the dock and the JEAs and the level of enforcement and what percentage of violations from dockside activities?
Paul, good question. And that was one of the additional addressed through the IG review. And down in Silver Spring, we're in the final stages of updating our reporting system to actually withdraw that data. That was, we took a hit on that. And one of the jobs that Sheila Johns is slowly trying to get her handle on is how to best report that compliance effort, that enforcement effort, in more of a metrics-based, so we can watch that trend. Last thing, Chairman, Mr. Chairman, I forgot to mention one other thing. We no longer have enforcement litigation attorneys here in the Northeast. So our cases, for now into the near future, will be litigated on the civil side, litigated up at our general counsel headquarters. And at a conference call I had last week, we're looking at about 100 cases pending action up at general counsel, depending on how they disperse those cases. So there may be a lag right now as far as some of our activity as far as what the resolution is.
So you have no attorney capacity in the region?
That is correct, sir. It's all done out of headquarters now.
Because?
Both Mitch McDonald and Deirdre Casey have transferred over to other divisions within general counsel.
Would seem like if you're going to transfer some capacity out, you'd transfer some new people in to fill the crack, right?
That was what I would wish for, sir.
Okay. Rodney?
Yeah, those 18 new offices, are they to replace the agents you have in ports like New Bedford already, or are they to assist them? Or is it a completely different role?
It's actually a combination. Right now, we're still under a hiring freeze for criminal investigators, and most of the vacancies that we're going to see are, we're not filling those with agents. We're filling them with enforcement officers. We're still at a capacity and a full-time billet capacity. So in lieu of hiring agents, the direction now is to hire more officers. And it's going to be a combination role as far as them assisting that.
So the new officers are going to presume the same role as the enforcement agents you have?
No, sir. There'll be more of a compliance outreach waterfront presence where the agents will be focusing more on the complex and criminal investigations.
So they're going to do outreach as well as enforcement. Well,
correct.
I just got a little tip. Uniforms and outreach do not mix. Most fishermen, when they see a uniform, they go the other way. So that's just my opinion.
Denver, we got our work cut out, and we hope it's going to work.
Right, Beth?
Yeah, I kind of had that same reaction. You know, you think in terms of, you know, how are the fishermen going to perceive these new uniform officers on the dock? And I realize that you all are trying to respond to the report and be proactive, but I am concerned that fishermen's perception of that on the dock is going to be something totally different. And that they see new uniform armed officers on the dock, that you're going to get the opposite reaction than what you're really looking for. I'm not sure exactly how you deal with that, but I mean, I think it is a problem.
I understand a lot of the same information has provided back up the chain, including to the back to response to the IG. This is an evolution with NOAA right now for enforcement program. And my goal is to make it work.
How's VMS doing? I heard Dave Gaethel's report, and I'm
morning,
sure
there's
more. Good morning. How are you?
Mr. Chairman, council members, this first day of summer, a beautiful day in Portland. For those that don't know me, Bill Semro, Northeast VMS program manager, and it's been good working for Tim these last several months as the acting SAC. I think he's done a good job of keeping things together despite all the swirling issues and attacks. Let me go through the active VMS population in the Northeast is 1,087 vessels. That's about two-thirds of where we were a few years ago. We're up over 1,500 vessels. And when I say active, I mean registered with NMFS, either sending a signal to us or they're in a authorized power down letter of exemption status, 1,087. Of those 1,000 plus vessels, that's 420 ground fish sector vessels. I know that Pat mentioned 829 elected to join a sector this year. We've got 420 that are actually active in the VMS population and 127 common pool. For scallop limited access with VMS requirements, categories 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, there are 345 holding those permits that are active VMS vessels, 625 LAGC scallop, 723 surf clam quahog, Maine mahogany quahog, and 84 herring limited access A, B, and C, and 479 monk C, D, and F. Moving on, we rolled out a new software update in late April, effective for use on May 1. We still got a number of SkyMate vessels that need to upgrade, and we're reaching out and making sure that they use the current software. That software includes a generic power down declaration, as the council approved region approved a power down exemption for the sector, certain sectors. And that power down declaration can also be used by the LAGC scallop vessels. We did away with the scallop power down. We now have this generic power down. The important thing to note about that power down declaration, the reason I mention it is, for the LAGC scallop vessels and the sector vessels that are authorized to use it, it can only be used if they don't have more restrictive VMS permits. And that seems to confuse some folks. So if you have more restrictive permits requiring your unit beyond 24/7 or that you get a letter of exemption, then you must do so, of course, and you can't use the power down declaration. We're coordinating another software update for September 1st. That'll be to support the herring regulatory changes. I know this may be a non-starter, but I think it's worth noting anyway that it is challenging for both VMS and for the industry, I believe, when we do multiple VMS software updates in a given year. When we rolled out the May software, we, of course, rolled out changes to VMS forms that were based on approved regulatory actions, but there were also changes that were based on pending regulatory actions. And we, of course, we had to be very careful how we handled that and addressed that in the permit holder letters. But I think it adds just another layer of confusion, and I think it's worth noting that if there's a way of coordinating the timing of various regulatory actions, it might be something the council wants to consider in the future. Moving on, with regards to the VMS operator instructions, I revised those. I tried to kind of simplify them and speak directly to the VMS operators and how they use the VMS and the reporting requirements of the VMS system. That new operator instruction is on the Northeast VMS webpage. You find it under the Nero, on the Nero website. It's a little daunting to look at because it's 56 pages, but the operator instruction itself is only 16. The other 40 pages are attachments, enclosures showing all the screens for the three vendors, SkyMate, Botrax, and Tron, what are required fields and what are optional or conditional fields. So all the information is in there, and I hope that either owners, operators would take the time to look at that, and I think it will answer a lot of their questions. Of course, the Northeast VMS team is always there to respond to questions. We like talking to owners and operators, and we encourage them to call us at 978-281-9213, and that's the main number. And the point of contact, phone numbers, email addresses are all in the operator instructions. Finally, I do have a VMS programmer on staff. I've had him now for several months. I found out that we are going to be able to extend his contract for another year, which is great because he's developed an excellent internal web page, which is populated with various VMS reports, which is used by the VMS team to more efficiently monitor and to assist with compliance efforts. This particular programmer also has analytical skills, and we're using those skills in coordination with our headquarters to take a hard look at VMS data latency, something which Dave Gaethel brought up a little while ago regarding sending hails through VMS using SkyMate. And, of course, latency is a concern of both the agency and the industry because it affects both data quality and processes that require timely reporting and response, like sending a hail to a dockside monitor and getting a return response. I do want to mention that the standard for transmission of VMS messages is that 97% of them must be transmitted and received within 15 minutes. That means 3% could be considerably greater than that and still meet the standard. We do know that there is, you know, a vendor that we need to look at much closer and determine where the improvements could be made. This has been a long-term problem. It also happens to be a vendor that's a low-cost alternative to some of the others. So, with that, that concludes my VMS brief. Mr. Chairman, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Any questions for the dynamic duo? Rodney?
Yeah, you said that 98% are within 15 minutes. How 90, long? Huh?
97. Right.
How long is the time lapse between the other 3%?
Yeah, that can vary quite a bit.
Like a month?
No.
No.
Okay, good point. All right, in context, I would say several hours in some cases. Yeah. It's one of the reasons, Rodney, why for those vessel operators, when they cross the demarcation line and they start a trip, they don't see their trip start message for usually a couple of hours after they cross the line. We do that on purpose, you know, because our trip generation program waits 2 hours to collect the positional data. You know, you might get some data out of order where you get a later position, earlier than an earlier position. We want to make sure we start a trip on the first position seaward of DMARC. So we wait for that data. And we found that within 2 hours, you know, we'll get, you know, 98, 99% of the data within that, and that we felt was a reasonable compromise. You know, we don't want to send it right after they cross DMARC, and we don't want to send it 24 hours after they cross DMARC.
Okay. No, because I heard some, and it wasn't David, but I've heard some other SkyMate vendors saying that they send the report and they never even hear from it anymore. They never get a response ever again, like it's lost in air.
Yeah, briefly, I believe I'd mentioned this before. We know quite well that with SkyMate satellite provider, Orbcomm, that Orbcomm has within their satellite network of the 30 or so satellites, one of the planes, and they've got four planes, A, B, C, and D, D plane has a problem. When that D plane's overhead and the vessel is trying to communicate and, you know, it's communicating with a D plane satellite, there's going to be more than likely increased latency. And we're seeing it because our trip generator will stop automatically if there's a problem with the data coming in within, you know, we're expecting a certain amount of data within an hour. If it falls below a threshold, it stops so that we make sure that we're generating clean trips. The declaration with the position report as a trip, because that's going into the vessel's AMS system. So it's, you know, it's sort of something we're very, very conscious of. And sometimes those messages go through, but you don't get the acknowledgement. Okay?
That's what they're saying. They never get the acknowledgement back that somebody's received it.
Right. And with the hail message, the VMS hail message is optional, you know, whereas the other VMS forms are required. You know, the catch reports, the pre-landings, the declarations, et cetera. The hail is optional. It's whatever the sector manager puts in their sector operations plan as to what methods of sending a hail message their member vessels can use, you know, whether it's radio or whether it's cell phone or, you know, some other method. VMS is one of those. And, yes, it is a problem because you're expecting to send it and you're expecting to get a reply from the dockside monitor.
So let me see if I understand this. So if the sector manager chose not to get a, for the, anybody in that sector, not to get a return compliance message, and these fishermen don't know about it, they're in that sector, so that might be part of the reason. Is that correct?
No, I don't think the sector manager is choosing not to have the dockside monitor reply. What I'm saying is there are alternate methods for sending the hail message, okay, to the dockside monitor. You know, pick up the cell phone if that's what's authorized in the op plan. Call the dockside monitor. Dockside monitor can call them back. Say you're waived or you're going to be monitored when you come in. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds like they need to replace the plan.
Yeah.
The D-plane?
Excuse me? Yes.
Got to replace D-plane?
Yeah. Well, they got a dead satellite up there, and they, you okay. know, and so they, yeah. Right. The last thing I heard was the first quarter of this fiscal year, they were supposed to do something, and that has since passed. So we're waiting for an update on when they're going to correct that.
Mary Beth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick question. Bill, you mentioned a link on the Nero site to those instructions, and I couldn't find it. Could you just tell us once more time how to get there?
Yeah, the I know the web page, the Nero website, you know, changed a bit in its presentation. If you go to, I think it's, was it fish dealers and fishing industry homepage? I don't know if somebody's on there, but it will bring a drop-down menu, and at the very bottom of that menu will be the VMS program. Are you there? Yeah. What is the header again? Can you help me out? It used to be fishing industry homepage, but now it's I think it's dealers and
fishing industry and seafood dealers.
There we go.
That was the
okay.
right header.
Yeah. And you'll find VMS there. Yeah. Okay. And there's a wealth of information on that page. We're trying to demystify the program and, you know, help people understand the requirements.
Dave Gave.
Yeah. I did want to say for the record that, you know, Bill's team has worked very hard on solving these issues. I mean, Bill's been down on my boat several times with other people. They've taken a look at it. You know, we've done projects with SkyMate to try and get it. Hit these problems. This rises above the regional office at this point. This is something Washington's got to get involved in and deal with. You know, as an example right now, I mean, I watched the statistics and the only satellites that are coming up are the D-plane satellites. I don't know what's happened to A, B, and C, but they're totally MIA at the moment. And it used to be C was the only one you could ever get anything to go through on. I sit there and watch the D one sit there. It's a very low trajectory, I guess, at least on the little screen. It's always down there in the corner. And, you know, it comes on for a fraction of a second, and that's just not enough time to send the message that has to be sent. Now, I do think that the VMS people should be given credit for simplifying the forms, for simplifying the number of characters that have to be sent. And that has improved, at least with the acknowledgments, from what I can see, greatly. The acknowledgments are coming back much more regularly and much quicker than they used to under the previous software. And the sent form that you send with your VMS number on it, at least according to the machine, it says sent. So I assume it's gone, as opposed to a lot of times the trip start and end will say processing, and they sit there and say processing for hours, and then finally they just get a blank line. You get a straight line through them where apparently they just processed them out and nothing ever happened. So I just, again, like to say that I think at this point it really is time for Washington to take this situation and deal with it, because I don't think it's a regional office problem anymore.
There are, if I may briefly, there are five regional VMS program managers. I'm obviously one of them, and latency is very sensitive in this region and not so much in the other regions because of the kind of program that we run here. And I have been in contact with the acting national VMS program manager, Logan Gregory, in pushing this latency issue and making sure that we're gathering the right stats, and that's why I mentioned in my brief that I've got my programmer looking at it as well, because he has that ability to go in and start pulling some data for the Northeast region. And our headquarters has been has a latency report they send to us, the regional managers, daily. I have questions about that particular report and what exactly it's measuring, because the last thing we want to do is send data back to the VMS vendors that's inaccurate. And we want to hold them to the standard, but it's just getting there and getting the data and getting accurate data and making sure we've got we have a solid argument to go to them with. So thank you.
Thank you. Harriet? With Tim Donovan. Come on up, Harriet. Tim doesn't bite.
As far as the offices or whatever you're calling them, I was at the Senate hearing yesterday, and Inspector Zinser used the word when they were talking about the offices and guns, and that I believe the suggestion was better to be, and the first word he used I thought was regulatory, and I don't remember the second word he used. But my question is, what is the difference between the men that are now going to do, what are they going to do, and what is the difference between them and the people who have been, had the presence before? What's the difference in their credentials, how they're going to handle situations? What are really the differences now that you're putting together than what was going on before?
The big difference from the group of uniformed enforcement officer and the criminal investigator, outside of the actual federal standards and classifications of their positions, is the special agents are going to be far more focused on the complex investigations, the criminal investigations, whereas the enforcement officers are going to try to bridge that gap. In the past, where we were had a far more presence on the waterfront, we were working more on a daily basis with the industry. And I think, as I understand it from Inspector General's review, and what NOAA wants us to do is they want us to get back towards that direction. Right now, that avenue we're looking for is that uniformed enforcement officer. Not to say that they won't have the ability to write a ticket when they come across a violation, but their primary focus is to work with the industry to improve compliance and have that more of that daily contact, which we don't have right now and haven't had recently.
But what are, you know, Magnuson, most of what it is, if not all of it, a civil. It's civil penalties. So when you talk about criminal, what are these people? Are they policemen? Are they something new you're forming? Or what is it, a different pay scale now they'll be under? Because, of course, we've read about a lot of these officers, or whatever you want to call them, before went and took other courses, and that upped their pay scale because they were criminally certified. What is the real differences, and what is the real differences of what they'll be doing, and we'll be wearing uniforms? What kind of uniforms? I mean, what will be different with them than when you would call on the phone before and they'd answer the phone and they'd say, special agent, whoever? What are the differences?
The big difference is, and this is before my time with the Office of Law Enforcement here in the Northeast, is we had, you know, over 10 years ago, we had enforcement officers doing the same, you know, doing their job that they're going to be doing again this time around. For a variety of reasons, they transitioned more to the special agent, the 1811 criminal investigator, because it was the best tool in the toolbox. They had the skills to handle all the cases and with limited resources. Unfortunately, that's going to change now, and we're going back towards more of a model that Alaska has, where they have the criminal investigators handling the complex criminal and high-end civil investigations, which we know still that activity happens. And then the enforcement officers, the guys on the waterfront, will be out there working with industry, still trying to improve that compliance rate and maintain that rapport with the industry.
What would be what Mr. Fry, what would he be like on a liaison, or what would be his, what is his role?
Don is a new breed. What we try to do is fill a position that doesn't involve an enforcement action. Don Fry has no ability or authorization to take an enforcement action. His job will be to help us do our job better by providing that feedback, working with the industry, and you know, folks may want to talk to him more than they want to talk to a person that can write them up at the end of the day. And this is one avenue where we're going to try. It's brand new. We believe it will be successful. It's a pilot program here in the Northeast, the Don Fry position, and as I understand it, they're leaning towards going that in every division.
So basically there's really not a difference of what we had before. The people coming are still, they still have guns. They're still basically, they're the same people. It's just maybe they wouldn't, I mean, you're saying, say Mr. Fry, if I had some questions or I knew he was coming to my port, I might call him and sit down and talk to him about the regulations. But you're still going to have these other people who are going to, do they circulate around, or would they be, when you call, they don't say special agent, they say enforcement officer. If you call them for, say, I could call them for a technical question on maybe the regulations, and sometime they can straighten that out. There isn't, I don't really see a big difference. Maybe there's going to be a difference in attitude, but as far as the guns, the presence of the person, as Rodney and Mary Beth said, it's still more or less the same visual.
Correct. It's going to be it's the same. That part of it, the visual part, I can't control. It's the method they use, the function that they, the production and function that they will have, vice what the agents will be doing.
So what I heard yesterday from Inspector Zinser, when he used the word regulatory, and then I should have written down the second word, that is yet is not on, is not what any of these people are called.
And no, the job series is regulatory inspection. It doesn't take away the law enforcement factor. What Zinser was saying is he wanted less criminal investigation work based on the federal standards, and that's what, you know, he was addressing. And the other avenue that we have and know what to use is, because it's an existing position that we have, very effective in Alaska, is the enforcement officer. Under their categories, the classifications in the 1801 or 1802 series, it's regulatory inspection.
So what's an example of, say, one of these people in Alaska would do? What would be an example of for instance, what they'd be doing?
Again, it's they'll be down on the waterfront, whereas, you know, the hit we took is that we didn't have the presence as we used to have down the waterfront, that we were too involved in criminal investigations. I'm not going to deny that. We have been very involved and very productive in our criminal investigations. Unfortunately, you know, the IG felt that we needed to get back into that venue of being involved down the waterfront. What resource we have available to us right now is the enforcement officer. The new addition would be Don Fry.
But these people actually have the same power as the others before.
No, they won't be handling criminal investigations. They're
right,
not investigators.
When any of these really investigations, aren't most of when they start, involved with Magnuson, and that's what I'm talking only about Magnuson, they're really civil anyhow.
Correct.
So I still don't see any line of difference.
Maybe
there's something written that is going to be something written put out that I could read, and that probably would help me, and then I could call you with questions.
Okay, I'll try to address that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Harriet. Paul Howard.
The way I see it, Tim, is that right now there's enforcement dockside done with JTAs, with uniform JEAs, with uniform state officers carrying guns. Now they're going to be complemented by federal guys doing enforcement carrying guns. So that I don't think the fishermen are going to see any difference than a JEA uniformed officer and a NIMS uniformed officer. It's dockside enforcement.
Correct. The only difference that what will be evaluated at the end of the day is that federal activity vice where the full-time federal vice JEA/state. So.
Harriet, Harriet, we can't have a big back and forth.
I'll talk to him in the back.
Thank you. Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tim, just a couple more thoughts here. I mean, Harriet Rodney's and Dave's comments all underscore my previous comment about concern about compromising the collaborative relationship that Maine Marine Patrol has developed with our fishermen here. So I don't really see, to Paul's comment there, what the difference between the duties between the uniformed state officers and the uniformed federal officers. My concern is aside from the funding issue, which I think eventually will be eroded if this program continues, is that the duplication is going to compromise the long-standing relationship that we've built with the industry. And I just hope that there's a review program in place so that and that you'll work actively with Colonel Fezzenden to synchronize with his officers, because we've done a pretty solid job of working with our JEA.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. We got to keep going. We're already a half hour off schedule. We'll ask for an update, obviously, next council meeting. You'll have a lot more clarity on who the big cheese is going to be and all the other hires. And thank you. Anything supremely important to report from ASMFC? Supremely important. You all know what that means. Doug.
I'll make it just very quick. There would have been no ASMFC meeting that's taken place since our April meeting, but I wanted the council to be aware that the northern shrimp section of ASMFC is in the process of developing Amendment 2 to the northern shrimp section plan, and in our last development meeting, we established a control date of June 7th that needs to be approved by our policy board on in August. And in that amendment, the reason we're looking at a control date is because we're looking at limited access, among a lot of other measures, to try and improve our shrimp management here in the future.
Terry?
Of supreme importance to the herring fishery is another landing, is the herring section's meeting this Friday to review the rate of catch and determine the landing days for the beginning of July.
Okay, thank you. We'll take a quick break when we come back. Review of press issues paper. Take a 10-minute break.